Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Trust is the most fickle of human emotions. It often takes us a long time to build it, but only a moment to abandon it. Some of us trust too easily, while others trust almost no one. Stephen Avery's attorney, Kathleen Zellner, admits that she's the latter.
It's sort of a joke in my office. I let my clerks do a lot of analysis and work and give me memos and all that, and I trust no one.
In the final episode of Making a Murderer's second season, though, Zellner asks for everyone's trust. That despite 9 episodes of misrepresenting and mischaracterizing evidence, she can finally deliver on 9 episodes of promises to overturn a murder conviction. That's asking for a lot of trust. My answer is to demand that she verify. I'm Dan O'Donnell, and this is Rebutting a Murderer. The episode opens with disappointment for Zellner as a Sheboygan County Circuit Court judge flatly denies her motion for a new trial.
You know, I would like to be diplomatic about this opinion, but it's hard to do that when I've got somebody's life at stake, and on the receiving end of it is someone who obviously who's making fundamental mistakes about the underlying facts in the case, and then is trying to go one-on-one with our scientist. It's just not at all what a judge should be doing.
As a matter of fact, it's exactly what a judge should be doing, assessing the quality of the arguments made by both parties before her and making a ruling on the issues raised. Zellner raises objections to Judge Angela Sutkowitz leaving out of that ruling a discussion of several points Zellner raised in her motion, but Zellner leaves out a key commonality underlying all of them. They didn't present any new evidence. Since Avery already appealed his case all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the state's court of last resort, and lost at every step of the way, Judge Sutkowitz's ruling was rightfully focused only on arguments that Avery had not raised before and new evidence uncovered by DNA testing. That testing, performed on the hood latch of Teresa Halbach's RAV4, the key found in Avery's bedroom, and the bullet found in his garage, quite simply did not yield definitive conclusions that would provide adequate grounds to grant a new trial. As Judge Sutkowitz noted in her opinion, Zellner's own experts in their affidavits did not draw definite conclusions about those items and instead typically concluded only that more testing is needed. All 3 items of evidence were admitted at trial, Sutkowitz writes. Each was thoroughly contested by defense counsel. The reports submitted by the defendant are equivocal in their conclusions and do not establish an alternate interpretation of the evidence. Given the totality of evidence submitted at trial and the ambiguous conclusions as stated in the experts' reports, it cannot be said that a reasonable probability exists that a different result would be reached at a new trial based on these reports. As such, the defendant has not met his burden in order to obtain a new trial. Judge Sutkowitz here has merely acknowledged a reality that rebutting a murderer has been pointing out for 9-plus episodes now. Kathleen Zellner's own experts do not support Kathleen Zellner's grandiose pronouncements. Undeterred by this resounding defeat, however, Zellner tries to bounce back by again advancing the evidence-free theory that Brendan Dassey's brother Bobby and stepfather Scott Tadick are Teresa Halbach's real killers.
Stephen Avery's attorneys pushing once again for a new trial.
In this motion, Avery's attorneys claim Bobby Dassey's computer had pictures on it of dead bodies of young women. She also claims Halbach and her vehicle left the Avery property.
Zellner alleges Bobby Dassey and his now stepfather, Scott Tadich, gave false testimony to cover up that they assaulted Halbach on a highway after she left Avery's property.
Needless to say, Bobby's father and Scott's wife, Barb Tadich, Stephen Avery's sister, was not pleased with this development and told her brother as much in a phone call to him in prison.
What the f*** is going on? what's going on?
Yeah. Why is she starting up with Scott and Bobby again?
Well, it's going wherever the evidence is going.
So she's going to take down my f***ing family again?
If that's where the lead is going to go, I don't know.
It f***ing better not, because you'll have a dead sister.
Well?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it was. It's kind of him. It's the other one.
Who's the other one?
Your husband.
He didn't do it either, Christ, Stephen. I was f***ing with him.
Well, you weren't with him all day.
I was with him from 5 o'clock on.
Yeah.
And, yeah, plus he was in the hospital with his mother for most of the day.
Well,
nothing.
I don't know about that either.
So you're actually thinking Scott did this?
Don't ask me. I don't know who did it. I know I didn't.
Well, neither did he.
Well,
and neither did Bobby.
Barb Totic is correct. There still is not a single shred of evidence tying either Bobby Dassey or Scott Totic to the crime. In fact, as Barb angrily reminded her brother in that phone call, Scott has an alibi for the night of the murder. He was with her. Before that, he had indeed been visiting his mother in the hospital in Green Bay, and then at about 3 o'clock that afternoon, went out to his deer stand to hunt for a little bit before returning home to pick up Barb and go back to Green Bay, where the two of them again visited his mother. At about 7:40 p.m., they returned to the Avery property, and Scott testified that when he dropped Barb off, he saw Stephen and Brendan standing next to a large fire behind Stephen's garage. At 8 p.m., Scott returned to his home to watch the TV show Prison Break. Barb came over and watched it with him. On the way to his deer stand, he testified that he passed Bobby Dassey driving down Highway 147 abutting the Avery scrapyard. While the common belief is that Bobby and Scott are each other's only alibis, this simply isn't true. Barb provides an alibi for Scott, while Bobby's brother Brian provides a partial alibi for him. Brian testified that Bobby and Brendan, along with a fourth brother, Blaine, were all home when he got back to shower up before heading to his girlfriend's house. Interestingly, Brian Dassey's testimony isn't mentioned in Making a Murderer in the context of providing Bobby Dassey with an alibi and with good reason. He also testified that he overheard Brendan talking with Stephen about needing some help doing something. When he left for his girlfriend's house at about 6:30 that evening, Brian saw smoke coming from behind his Uncle Stephen's garage, most likely from a fire in the burn pit, the same burn pit where Teresa Halbach's charred bones were found. Was Brian Dassey lying? Zellner never bothers to answer. She instead focuses on a Facebook post that Barb made the night of her angry phone call with Stephen.
That, for some reason, provoked Barb into talking to Bobby about exactly what he had said, what he was claiming about Teresa's visit to the property. And a new version emerged, according to Barb, which she posted on Facebook from Bobby, that he actually had never seen Teresa walk towards Stephen's trailer, which of course means he committed perjury at the trial. We then took that information and that phone conversation, and we filed a supplement on November 1st.
Interestingly enough, though, Zellner never bothered to obtain an affidavit from Barb or subpoena her to force her to testify under oath about what she had said randomly on Facebook. Why not? If her Facebook statement was so damning to Bobby's credibility, why not have her testify to that effect? The answer is rather obvious. It's hearsay and thus inadmissible as evidence.
I had never looked at the underlying reports of Eisenberg, and so I was going through her notes, and what caught my eye was the numbering of the tag numbers.
Zellner here claims that she's found a bombshell, that forensic anthropologist Leslie Eisenberg, who examined the bone fragments found in Stephen Avery's burn pit and burn barrel and other bones found in the nearby quarry, stated definitively that bone fragments found in the quarry were human.
I, of course, knew 8675 was the quarry pile with the pelvic bone in it. But then I saw on the sheet of paper a different numbering sequence in the 7400s. This was different evidence. These were different bones. And then I started reading the content of it, where in great detail, Leslie Eisenberg has documented that there are more human bones. And then I'm noticing not only that, but she's documenting that they have cut marks on them.
Here, Zellner trusts that Making a Murderer viewers will not have gone back and read the trial transcripts. Dr. Eisenberg did indeed mark those bone fragments as human bones in her initial examination of them. She testified at trial that upon closer examination, she found they were not human bones at all. A total of 13 questionable bones were found in the quarry. 10 of them were determined to be animal bones. 3 of them were too small to be identified as either human or animal, but are more than likely animal because they were found in an area where a hunter had rather obviously cut up a kill. That explains the cut marks on the animal bones. Amazingly, though, Zellner never clears this up and gives Making a Murderer viewers the impression that Teresa Halbach's bones were definitely found in the quarry. They most definitely were not, and Zellner knows that they're not. Remember, she had what she claimed was a human pelvic bone in her possession and could have tested it. She either didn't or didn't present the evidence of that testing in any of her motions for a new trial. Why not? If that testing showed Teresa Halbach's pelvic bone was found in the Manitowoc County quarry and not in Stephen Avery's burn pit, why not present this bombshell evidence? Because it's not bombshell evidence at all. It's not a human bone. None of those bones are. If that wasn't enough to shake your faith in what Making a Murderer has been showing you this season, its depiction of former Manitowoc County Coroner Deborah Kakich should.
Significant evidence has been discovered over the past 24 hours at the Avery Salvage Yard.
I found out from the media that there was possibly some remains found on the Avery property. There was a press conference that was on television, I believe it was November 9th, around 3 p.m., that was confirmed.
They feel that the evidence that they are that has been collected and that they are analyzing is that of human in nature.
Prior to that, I had no knowledge or reports given to me by police or detectives.
Kakich claims that the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department violated the law in refusing to allow her to come to the scene to investigate the death.
And I told them I wanted to come out to the scene. They told me the scene was closed for the night. And I said, okay, you know, that's fine, but why didn't you give us some kind of report, some kind of a heads up as to what was going on? And then he commented to me at that time very rudely, well, I don't have to call or tell you about bones. And I said, oh, yes, you do. It's the law, it's the statute, 979. When there is a deceased body or remains that a coroner, a medical examiner are always notified, they handle the medical forensic side of the body. The next day in the morning, I was going to go out to the scene and I was called to a meeting by Sheriff Peterson. I thought, oh good, I'm finally getting a meeting. I'm finally going to get a update on what's going on and when I will be able to come out to the scene. But when I got there at that time, I was told I will not be going out to the case. I will not be going out to the scene. And if I do, I will be arrested.
This exchange, if it ever actually happened, is not nearly what Making a Murderer presents it to be. Remember, because of the ongoing lawsuit Avery had filed against Manitowoc County, not just the Sheriff's Department, but the government of Manitowoc County, the county allowed neighboring Calumet County to lead the investigation. Because both counties are relatively small, Manitowoc County Sheriff's deputies were allowed to assist in the investigation. Remember deputies James Lenk and Andrew Colburn, two of the villains of Making a Murderer's first season? They were allowed to assist in the investigation precisely because they personally had the fewest prior dealings with Avery and least ties to the lawsuit, and thus were presumed to be far enough removed from the case to at least assist Calumet County and state investigators. Ironic, huh? Lenk and Colburn didn't lead any investigation. They merely helped out. Calumet County, which had no motive to frame Stephen Avery and has never been implicated in any of the frame-up conspiracies, took the lead, and naturally they notified the Calumet County Medical Examiner once human remains had been found at the Avery scrapyard. Here's the thing, though. Investigators didn't find a body. They found tiny bone fragments. Essentially, there was nothing for a coroner to investigate. The bone fragments were immediately taken to the Wisconsin State Crime Lab to be analyzed. A local coroner would not have been able to identify the body at the scene. He or she would not have been able to identify a cause or manner of death at the scene. A coroner at the scene was therefore unneeded. Deb Kakich was told to stay away because she had no jurisdiction over the matter at all. This was not her investigation. It was not Manitowoc County's investigation. It was Calumet County's. Zellner then returns to her analysis of the Dassey family's computer and expresses outrage that a CD-ROM of data found by Grand Chute Police Detective Michael Veely was never turned over to the defense until 2018, 11 years after Avery's trial.
If you look at the fact that the Veely report, the forensic analysis of the computer, was completed on May 10th of 2006, the Fassbender report was not turned over, even mentioning the CD, until December of 2006. And the Fassbender report says the disc received from Detective Veely, as well as the hard copy pages of instant message conversations, were maintained in Fassbender's possession. So 2,400 pages of evidence is kept by Fassbender and not given to the defense. It was never, ever given to the trial team, the appellate team. It was not disclosed until it was given to me.
This is not even remotely true. Stephen Avery's attorneys had every bit of data from the Dassey computer on December 14th, 2006. All of the contents of the hard drive were turned over on 7 CD-ROMs. There was no new information given to Zellner 12 years later. She already had access to all of it. So did Avery's attorneys at trial. In a second motion for a new trial filed with Judge Sutkiewicz in 2018, Zellner alleged that withholding the so-called Veely CD amounted to a violation of Brady v. Maryland, which requires that the prosecution in a criminal matter turn over all potentially exculpatory evidence to the defense. Sutkiewicz found that there was no Brady violation whatsoever since, as she wrote, the defendant's own computer expert asserts that the same information presented in the Veely CD was in the possession of the defense on the 7 CDs turned over by the prosecution in December of 2006, almost 2 months prior to the beginning of trial on February 12, 2007. In an even more damning passage in her ruling, Judge Sutkiewicz reminds Zellner that Avery's trial defense actually stipulated to the conclusions of both the Veely CD and Fassbender's report on it, but chose not to raise them in court. As Sutkiewicz wrote, Attorney Strang was in possession of Special Agent Fassbender's report revealing the work of Detective Veely. He acknowledged the detective's review of the drives when discussing the stipulation proposals and concluded that the information on the drive in question was irrelevant, a result of a strategic decision on the part of the defense rather than misconduct on the part of the prosecution. In other words, Zellner's wild accusations about the state withholding evidence from her are either out-and-out lies or the result of her not knowing her client's case as well as she thinks she does. Either way, her motion was swiftly rejected in September of 2018. After Making a Murderer's final episode expresses the requisite outrage that the full Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against Brendan Dassey, his attorney prepares viewers for the inevitable.
The United States Supreme Court gets thousands of requests to take cases each year. And out of those thousands, they take about 80 cases. Today's Supreme Court decision not to hear Dassey's appeal means that lower court ruling will stand, as does his sentence of life in prison.
Justices did not say why they won't take the case. It was Dassey's last option for appeal.
Wisconsin's attorney general saying he hopes Teresa Halbach's family can now find some comfort and closure with the court's decision.
The Halbach family will get neither. And neither will the Dassey family. Because even as Brendan now knows that he will almost certainly spend several more decades in prison for his crimes, his uncle Stephen is still trying to secure his freedom by having an attorney and a documentary crew pin the blame for his crimes on others, regardless of the fact that there's no evidence to support their ever wilder and more desperate theories. Those theories, like every conspiracy theory both Making a Murderer and Stephen Avery have ever advanced, essentially boil down to trust, the most fickle of human emotions. Avery, through his attorney Kathleen Zellner, is asking for your trust. Zellner is asking for Avery's trust and, by extension, yours as well. Trust her, she knows what she's doing. Trust her, she's got another card up her sleeve. Trust her, she'll win in the end. But by the end of Making a Murderer's second season, she sounds like her trust in herself is waning.
This story, you know, the story of Stephen Avery's life, whether I win in court or just making known what happened to him if he doesn't survive, is something that I'm completely committed to doing because it is such a tragic story.
It is, but not for the reasons she thinks it is. The real tragedy is the betrayal of trust of millions of people. The real tragedy is that through a constant stream of misinformation, mischaracterization of evidence, and outright deception, a television show has tricked millions into believing a murderer's lies. The real tragedy is that in spite of a mountain of evidence proving Stephen Avery's guilt, there are still those willing to ignore it and to instead believe in theories for which no actual evidence exists. That's the funny thing about trust. Sometimes it operates a whole lot like blind faith. And even when concrete, irrefutable evidence arises that disproves one's theories, there's a tendency to ignore that evidence and to continue to trust in the theory. That's all that the second season of Making a Murderer really was. An exercise in misplaced trust. Trust in Stephen Avery, trust in Kathleen Zellner, trust in the filmmakers themselves to tell an honest story. For a second season now, they didn't. And in fact, spent 10 episodes proving only that they are unworthy of your trust. It's still unclear whether there will be a third season of Making a Murderer, whether there really is more of the Stephen Avery story left to tell. But if there is, I will be right here to counter it. Trust me. I'm Dan O'Donnell, and this has been Rebutting a Murderer.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.